This is Pacifica's 9/11's imprint on America, 10 years later. This hour brought to you by WBAI.
I always knew about BAI through my father. And since 9/11, that day, I realized how fake the media was. And then I started listening to BAI. And ever since then, I've been listening to BAI since 9/11. That's why I called. Okay? Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Judith Pierre. I'm calling from Oakland, California, to share that 10 years later, I'm really sad because of what the United States has done in the name of revenge. I'm sorry that we couldn't do more to stop the subsequent wars that we initiated in the name of avenging this event. And I'm also sad about the way we treated the rescue workers.
Hi, I was at the University of Baltimore in Baltimore, Maryland, where at a meeting when we got the news of the attacks. They tried to continue the meeting, but then when they realized how serious it was, they stopped the meeting. I immediately went to our provost and said, we have to be sure that no attacks occur on our Islamic students, our Muslim students, who we had a number of at the University of Baltimore.
Hi, my name is Arnold Freeman. I'm calling from Peekskill, New York. I remember I was home that day. I worked for an agency that was destroyed in the World Trade Center. I knew people that were killed, and how it changed my life. It made to reevaluate that, you know, life is very precious, and that's why, you know, I support Pacifica absolutely. Without Pacifica, I don't think, you know, I don't know if I would have made it.
On this exact day, 10 years ago, New York and the world were in a virtual state of shock from the horrific attacks. Today, commemorative events are taking place throughout the city.
We bring you a National Pacifica special titled 9/11's Footprint on America. I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Michael and I were both downtown, really, on 9/11. I don't want to go into all the details. I was jogging past the building. Michael just avoided death by not being in the top of one of the buildings where he sometimes had breakfast. But all that is not beside the point. It's actually part of the point. The point is that since 9/11, we've seen historic depredations of liberty in this country, around the world, historic grabs for executive power, incredible number of wars around the world, and unbelievable attacks on Muslims. In this 1 hour, we will try and give you some sense of each of those. We'll begin with talking about the war since 9/11 in a wonderful and interesting segment. We'll then have me and Michael Smith discussing the Guantanamo syndrome. That's all of the, what I call, Operation Condor issues coming out of Guantanamo and the torture rendition regime around the world. Then we'll go into the surveillance state, how our liberty at home is essentially vanished, our right to protest. And then we will close with the incredible attacks on Muslims that are going on in this country. It's been a rough, rough 10 years.
When I heard the crash, and my wife said, what do you think that was? I said, could have been a car. What else could it be? And I went outside to take a look, and I saw that building burning. And I came back up, and then I heard the second crash and went out again and saw those two buildings falling down. We knew then that this was a game changer.
I wrote an article a few weeks afterwards, even before Guantanamo, saying police state has it arrived. And at that point, we only had in front of us the Patriot Act, not only the Patriot Act, the authorization to use military force with authorized the war in Afghanistan.
Military Order Number 1.
We just had Military Order Number 1. We didn't know about warrantless wiretapping. We didn't have the war in Iraq. We didn't have secret sites. We didn't have torture. I already thought we were approaching a police state. Now, of course, for many people, the police state is alive and well. Whether it's the Muslim subjects of persecution in the United States, whether it's the people who were kept in secret sites, whether those people 10 years now lingering still in Guantanamo. So today I think we have a really important one-hour show to share with you on some of the key aspects that we have suffered in the last 10 years under what you would have to say is essentially a dictatorial government. One of the major characteristics post 9/11 has been war. War in Afghanistan, war in Pakistan, war in Iraq, war in Yemen, war in Somalia, war in Libya. Today, to talk with us about these wars and the relationship to 9/11, we have Anthony Arnov. Anthony's view is that 9/11 was not the causes of these wars, but that this was set out way before, and that 9/11 was using an excuse to go to war against the people in Afghanistan, an excuse to go to war against the people in Iraq. What 9/11 has led us to, according to Anthony, is a state of perpetual war. And when he says perpetual war, he means not only the fact that we're in wars all the time, but that those wars are without end. So while you think that President Obama is beginning or is ending some of these wars, Anthony Arnov demonstrates that that is an untruth. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world will continue. It's one of the legacies of 9/11, but it's really more, as Anthony will explain, a legacy of the American empire. We're joined today by editor and writer Anthony Arnov. He's the author of many books, including Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Anthony, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Anthony, you've written an important article about looking back at the last 10 years of 9/11, and it particularly focuses on war. And can you just give us some sense? I know we're fighting a lot of wars. Are these the result of 9/11? What's going on?
Well, I think if you look back over the last 10 years, we can see continuity and discontinuity in U.S. foreign policy. The discontinuity is that 9/11 was seized upon by the Bush administration as an opportunity. In fact, Condoleezza Rice explicitly used the word opportunity to describe the geopolitical shifts that she saw occurring in the wake of 9/11, which allowed the United States to pursue a number of goals that it had previously, but to couch them as defensive rather than offensive measures. So it allowed it to project power, allowed it to intervene more forcefully in strategic areas of the world, particularly, of course, the Middle East and Central Asia. But to describe that as a defensive response to the horrific attacks of 9/11. So there was continuity and discontinuity. Continuity in the underlying interests and policies, discontinuity in that there was a world historic event that has really, to this day, continued to rupture and shake geopolitics. And in that 10 years since, of course, we've seen the invasion of Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan, the expansion of the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan into Pakistan, covert operations and aerial bombardment of dozens of countries. In fact, there's an estimate now that by the end of this year, as many as 120 countries the U.S. will be operating in some capacity through use of commandos like the Navy SEALs involved in the operation against Osama bin Laden, JSOC, and other commandos.
I thought that was an interesting figure you quoted, yeah, in which you said, at the end of the Bush administration, there were 60 U.S. Special Operation Forces in different countries. Then there were 75 under Obama, and as you just said, they'll be going up to 120.
Yeah,
that's basically almost every country in the world.
We've seen escalation under Obama of the use of these forces. Of course, we've seen an escalation of airstrikes over Pakistan, over Afghanistan. You've seen increased troop levels in Afghanistan, so that even with the current so-called drawdown of troops in Afghanistan, which is a reduction of troops that Barack Obama has introduced in his term in office, even with the reductions that are currently being undertaken, we're still going to be ahead of the number of troops that were in Afghanistan at the end of the Bush administration.
I thought that was also extraordinary. You're saying that. I mean, how many people out there know that we will have more troops in Afghanistan after the withdrawal than we had when Obama took office?
Yeah, I mean, just think of the language that we use, withdrawal. I mean, the word no longer has any meaning. I mean, withdrawal means pulling out. But the way the corporate media, the way the establishment press, the way our newsmakers, our politicians talk about this issue, withdrawal actually just means slight reduction of troops after they've been increased. And of course, right now the United States is looking to find ways to extend the troops that are in Iraq and that are supposed to leave under an agreement.
Let's mention Iraq. So we know with Afghanistan, there's going to be more troops after the withdrawal, if that ever even happens, than there were when Obama took office. Now with Iraq, I don't even, you know, it's sort of been off the front pages for a long time. I don't have any idea what's going on there, what the numbers are. Is there really going to be a withdrawal? How many people are going to be left?
Well, right now there are 46,000 active duty troops. But remember that for those active duty troops, there are many support troops and also, of course, mercenaries, private contractors who are still in Iraq in the tens of thousands. The claim is that those 46,000 would leave at the end of 2011 under an agreement that was reached under pressure from social movements in Iraq to remove all U.S. troops by the end of 2011. However, the evidence is very clear that the United States doesn't want to pull out those 46,000 active duty troops. They're trying to find ways to keep a number of them in. A number that's often thrown around is 10,000. Beyond that, of course, talk of having advisors, military trainers stay behind. And then you look at the U.S. military installations, which scatter the country. They're not going to walk away from those easily. And on top of that, you have in Baghdad the largest embassy that any government has ever built anywhere in the world. And of course, that is meant to stay there as an institution for the projection of U.S. power and influence and control in Iraq. And they're going to find ways to stay involved in that country for many years to come. And in Afghanistan, they're literally talking about dates as far into the future as 2024 now for continuing to have troops on the ground involved in a number of capacities.
I mean, I understand what you're saying about projection of U.S. power. Can you put Libya in that lens? I mean, how would you look at Libya?
Well, Libya, I think we've got to step back and understand that, of course, the U.S. has a history of intervening in Libya, bombing that country, interfering in its domestic affairs. But I think Libya is truly an opportunistic action by the United States, concerned that it was losing control in the Middle East. You've had uprisings and revolutions that have toppled governments aligned with the United States. Let's remember that Egypt was a long-time ally and friend of the United States, only after Israel, the second largest recipient of U.S. aid, long-term recipient of military and logistical support as it carried out its brutal and repressive policies internally. As these regimes were falling, the United States was put in a very difficult position of being seen to be on the side of anti-democratic forces and wanting to somehow insert themselves and reassert some control in this region. And they saw an opportunity to do so in Libya, which has an unpopular, hated leader, and where the social movement, the base of the social movement that was trying to topple Gaddafi, actually was very fractured and represented a lot of different social interests, including interests that could be more easily co-opted by the U.S. So I think they saw an opportunity to engineer the kind of regime change that would give legitimacy to the U.S. as it intervened elsewhere in the region, and also to bring into power a government more pliable, more controllable than Libya was under Gaddafi.
And they do it under the guise of extending democracy, which, after all, was the reason that they finally gave when weapons of mass destruction, which the New York Times echoed and the liberal press generally supported, when that proved to be a lie, then taking Saddam Hussein out in Iraq was done to extend democracy. And that's the same charade I think they're pulling in Libya. But I wanted to ask you a more fundamental question, because there's never been a discussion in the 10 years since 9/11 on why it happened. Bush said they did it because they hate us for our freedoms. Osama bin Laden, when interviewed, said, I did it for three reasons, and these have never been discussed. One is the United States' support of Israel against the Palestinians. The other is American bases in Saudi Arabia next to our sacred cities of Mecca and Medina. And the third is the American boycott in Iraq, which caused the death of so many Iraqis. That discussion has never gone on in this country.
Yeah, it's not possible to have a rational discussion of those topics. The rhetoric has been, exactly as you say, completely hollow claims about spreading democracy, spreading freedom around the world. Really, the best formulation I've heard of the rationale is not what Bush said, of course, that they hate our freedoms. It's actually that we, meaning our government, not we, the people of this country, but our government, hate their freedoms. The U.S. has been so contemptuous of the freedoms of people world, so contemptuous of democracy, so contemptuous of people fighting for self-determination, so contemptuous of nationalist movements that would have put resources under the control of the people and in the service of social need rather than serving Western corporations, Western interests, that they've a record of intervening for decades, now approaching really a century, to stop those democratic movements. And people understand that. And that is why the United States is hated in the world. And of course, the tragedy is that since 9/11, the actions of our government under Bush and now under Obama have only made us more hated and only made the world more dangerous. They claim that they're making the world a more stable place.
Do you think that the weakness of the anti-war movement here in the United States is due to the fact that we've got a black Democrat as a president?
You know, I recall that when people were out campaigning for Barack Obama, and I was not one of those people, and I've always felt that the anti-war movement in this country needed to be independent of the Democrats and the Republicans. It needed to be its own independent movement with its own independent demands and put pressure on whatever party is in power, whether it's Democrat or Republican, particularly given the extent to which there's been a bipartisan consensus between Democrats and Republicans on all of the fundamental aspects of the war on terrorism and the policies that we're discussing today.
What's interesting in your article on this issue is that you say that the base of the population, or at least a lot of the population, opposed the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I guess the question that you're addressing in here is, how do we bring that opposition to the fore? And you have some suggestions for that, but I'd be interested in your discussion of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to stress that even though the establishment media has had no anti-war voices to speak of. I mean, seriously, the anti-war movement has been silenced. Your ability to speak on Iraq or Afghanistan is basically premised on you having been wrong about both of those issues. So the people who most vociferously supported invading Iraq, claimed that there would be weapons of mass destruction, all of those things that we now know to be lies. Those people are regularly asked to be commentators on Iraq and Afghanistan.
I can't stand it, Anthony. When I see those guys go on,
right?
I mean, if anybody who could have gotten those wars wrong, to me, should have no credibility to stand in front of anybody to talk about what's going on.
I couldn't agree more. And yet the people who got it right, the people who spoke out against it, the people who said this is what will happen if we invade Iraq, those people are never heard from. So I say that just to say that there's a very interesting phenomenon. The press, you know, you mentioned earlier the New York Times. Of course, the New Yorker editorialized in favor of invading Iraq.
George Packer.
A lot of liberal intellectuals supported it. The culture, the political culture, clearly, overwhelmingly, was behind both the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and has continued to be largely supportive of these policies. And yet, we've seen ordinary people, without a very clear tribune in the popular culture, coming through their own process of reasoning and their own experiences to a different position, which is that a majority of people think it was a mistake now in both cases, Iraq and Afghanistan, to have gone in, that the price wasn't worth it. And I think that reflects a number of things. I think it reflects, one, the growing distance in our culture broadly. You know, we see this across so many elements of our politics. The gap between what the elite are doing and what they are saying and what is in their interest and the interest of ordinary people has just never been wider in this country. There's just a complete disconnect between those two things. It also reflects the fact that, economically speaking, inequality has continued to grow in this country. A lot of the people who've been asked to go fight in Iraq and Afghanistan come from working class communities and families. And those families are feeling the impact of the economic shifts of the last decade, as well as very directly the horrors of the soldiers who've gone and seen firsthand that they're not liberating anyone, but they're being asked to kill and die for a completely different set of reasons. And so communities are being torn apart by that. I think the soldiers who are speaking out in groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, the military families who have organized, those people have actually been able to have an impact, and ordinary people have come to their own far more incisive understanding of Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem is they don't feel there's a channel. They don't feel there's an outlet. They don't feel there's an organization, a way of influencing policy at the elite level. And so there is what I would argue a growing, pressing, urgent need to organize that sentiment, organize that feeling, organize that opposition into a more effective form of protest.
You mentioned October 6th in your article, and I don't think probably most of us know about October 6th and a new possible coalition. So why don't you talk about that a little, because it's the remedy. I mean, what you've laid out for us is not great. It's great the way you laid it out, but the last 10 years. But why don't you tell us about what you're thinking?
It's a modest step. What I'm describing here are the beginnings of a process of rebuilding the anti-war movement. But on October 6th, which is the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan, the beginning of that occupation, now approaching its 11th year, there will be organizations coming together, working together in Washington, D.C., and calling for solidarity actions in other cities to protest the Obama administration's continuing occupation of Afghanistan, and to link it to these broader issues that we're discussing. October 15th, actions have also been called for by a new organization called the United National Anti-War Coalition, and that is an effort to bring together forces from around the country to build an independent anti-war movement. That organization's been around for a couple of years now and is beginning, I think, to fill a gap that was left with the collapse of United for Peace and Justice and some of the other coalitions and organizations that really failed, unfortunately, to get further in building an anti-war movement under the Bush administration, and then largely collapsed in the build-up to the election campaign when so much energy and so many resources were diverted into getting Obama elected. We live in a topsy-turvy world. And a lot of people I know have been radicalized in this period since September 11th. A lot of people who were apolitical before have come into politics, have come to understand that they need to be involved, that they need to be engaged, that there's something wrong with the course that our political leaders are setting this planet on, and that it's not a sustainable course, whether through environmental destruction or nuclear conflict. It's a course that could literally lead to the annihilation of the human species unless we can intervene to radically turn the world in a different direction. And I think that would involve the kind of awakening in this country that we're seeing take place in Egypt and other parts of the Arab world as part of the Arab Spring. Ordinary people taking history, taking their fate into their own hands and saying, we have to find a different way of organizing and running our society, a more democratic, a more humane, a more sustainable one.
An American Spring. With that thought, Anthony Arnoff, hope you come back and talk with us very soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Michael.
It isn't just war on other countries and other peoples that 9/11 has brought us, but it's brought us the Guantanamo syndrome. You have war, and then you have the Guantanamo syndrome. Guantanamo syndrome is all of those things, if you're familiar with Operation Condor, which was Pinochet's efforts to round up opponents all over the world, imprison them, torture them, and murder them. This is now the American Operation Condor. And what America has done, what the United States has done, said it has the authority to detain, arrest, capture, or kill anybody anywhere in the world solely on the at the president's behest. If they're not killed, put them into an offshore prison camp forever, torture them in the offshore prison camp, not let them go here some 10 years later, still not let them go, pick them up from other countries, render them to other countries for torture. And if they decide in their good will to try somebody, try them before a rump kangaroo court called a military commission. That's the Guantanamo syndrome, and that's what we're going to talk to you about now.
Michael, soon after 9/11, President Bush signed the authorization for the use of military force, and that was followed by the military order number one.
Well, the authorization to use military force is the one that said they could basically make war on any person in the world or any nation or any group who the president thought might be involved in any way with 9/11. It has, of course, been broadened to that, so it includes now anybody the president, whether it's Obama or Bush, thinks is a, quote, terrorist or associated with a terrorist. So that's what allows them to use drone attacks everywhere in the world. That's what allows them to pick up people in Bosnia, the Philippines, anywhere in the world. So it is true that it's a key understanding of this is the authorization to use military force, Michael, is the key piece of legislation. And out of that legislation came military order number one, which was November 13th, 2001. And that's the order that the president took the authority of the authorization to use military force and said, I'm going to just order anybody I want arrested. They can be kept anywhere, American citizen or not eventually. And that's the authority. From there flows really what I would call the Guantanamo syndrome, which has all these aspects. And the first aspect is this one that the president believes that he has the authority to pick up, capture any person anywhere in the world without any court order, without any order at all, without any notice. That means he can swoop down tomorrow in New York, take someone, your neighbor, you, put you in a place where you're held incommunicado and not heard from again. And don't think that's just a Bush policy. We recently saw an example of that under Obama, where someone was picked up in a sea off of Africa, off Somalia, kept on a U.S. prison ship for 2 months and interrogated without any notion or any notice to the Red Cross. So that's an indication that the president still believes today that he has the authority first to pick up anyone anywhere in the world, hold them in an offshore prison, hold them incommunicado, and not notify the Red Cross. That's one.
But Center for Constitutional Rights, and you were president of it at the time, began the litigation against those policies. Give me in a nutshell what became of that litigation.
Well, that's really an important question, Michael. We saw this happening early on. We didn't know people would be taken to Guantanamo, but we said we'll represent the first people who are picked up under this AUMF and military order, authorization to use military force and military order number one. And eventually, we did get to represent the first people. They were sent to Guantanamo. And under the military order, the president had denied, this was President Bush, had denied people habeas corpus rights. Habeas corpus rights is just a fancy Latin word for saying a person who's a prisoner of the executive can go to court and say and put the executive on the defensive. Say, why am I being held? You have to have a legal basis. And the court has to decide, is there a legal basis for holding you in prison? And the Bush administration had said, we're not giving the right of habeas, we're stripping it. So after many years of litigation, 4 years or 5 years of litigation, representing these incommunicado people at Guantanamo, we wound up representing their parents or their relatives because we couldn't represent them, we couldn't see them or talk to them. The Supreme Court finally said, it's a constitutional right to go to court to test your detention. And they said that about the people at Guantanamo in particular. They did not say that about the people at Bagram or other places, other U.S. offshore prisons. That's a big opening right away, which means that we've only won the right for a very limited group of people who are sitting at Guantanamo. And then what happened is, once we won that right, the Bush administration and now the Obama administration has gone into court and completely opposed that right having any meaning. So, yes, I can file a habeas corpus petition for someone in Guantanamo, but then the court will either rule, well, yes, that person should be out, but I don't have the authority as the court to let them out. Only the president can let them out. So that's why we have people called the Uyghurs from Western China who are still sitting in Guantanamo some 10 years after they were picked up. They're still sitting there. So the court said, well, yeah, I can't let them out. Only the president can. Or what will happen is the court will rule they should be let out. And then a very conservative court of appeals who hates the Guantanamo habeas law has said, well, we don't think the lower courts were right about this, and have basically narrowed the right so that it's really illusory. And what's interesting about it, we won this crucial right, and no less than the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights said that the right of habeas corpus, which was won at Guantanamo, has essentially become an illusory right, which is why today we are sitting with 171 people still at Guantanamo. And I think when we talk about that 171, we should talk about the categories because they illustrate where this administration, the current administration, is going with the Obama syndrome. A group of those are people, 40 or 50, who are completely innocent of anything, according to even the government or habeas. They should be released yesterday, not tomorrow. And there's no plans to get them out of there. That means we have 50 innocent people having been kept at Guantanamo for 10 years. Then there's a group of people who the Obama administration, under a Bush scheme and now even worsened by Obama, called preventive detention. Those people, they say, well, we're not going to try those people for whatever reason. We think that they don't have the evidence, they're too dangerous, whatever reasons, we're just going to keep them indefinitely forever in prison. So now in this so-called bastion of liberty called the United States, we have a group of people who are being held without trial, without charges, just forever. And the third group will supposedly be tried. But of course, it's now been a couple of years for Obama in office or more, 2.5. How many trials have we seen? Well, you can count them, maybe one or two. And so we have another group of 40 who say they're going to try, haven't been tried yet. Charges haven't been preferred against them. And they even say that if they're tried, how are they going to be tried? They're not going to be tried in the courts we call criminal courts. They're going to be tried in military commissions, the rump kangaroo courts set up by the Bush administration, tinkered with by Obama, and now going to supposedly try these people. So here we're sitting with a scheme in which you pick people up all over the world, put them into Guantanamo or Bagram or other places, in which habeas is basically no good. It's no good anywhere else except Guantanamo, and it's no good at Guantanamo because you're still, it's illusory there. And then you're keeping people under three schemes. One is innocent because the president won't let them in, or the Congress won't let them in, or secondly, because they're in preventive detention, or thirdly, because they're going to be tried and they'll never be tried. That's the essence, really, in some ways, of what I call the Guantanamo syndrome. One piece we left out is, of course, torture.
Guantanamo was supposed to be closed, according to Obama's campaign promise, and also torture was supposed to be abolished.
This is true, Michael. A few days after he took presidency, he signed two executive orders saying Guantanamo to be closed in a year, torture to be ended. Well, certainly, as our listeners know, Guantanamo is there and flourishing, 171 people still there. His order was obviously wrong. He didn't do what he said he would do. He actually undercut it by even getting rid of some of the people who tried to close it. He bowed to the national security establishment, genuflect almost. So we still have it, and we still have little Guantanamos all over the world. So that's been a failure. Now, torture, you could say, and when I often talk about this, you could say he did a little better on torture. He actually got rid of the worst forms of torture, which is primarily waterboarding. Waterboarding and some other really bad things. But he left in, to the manual on how the military deals with people, he left in sleep deprivation, which, of course, is a form of torture. He left in isolation, which, of course, can be a form of torture. And he left in hooding. And the three of those, when combined together, there's almost no one who doesn't think that that's torture. So he's gone three quarters of the way, but he hasn't gone all the way. But the worst part about the torture issue to me is that he said he is not going to prosecute or investigate any of those key people involved in what I call the torture conspiracy.
He said we have to look forward, not backward. Right. What do you think of that?
Well, that's disingenuous because, of course, every prosecution has to look backward. And the only way in which you actually prevent torture going forward is by prosecuting the guys who did it in the past, backward. It's disingenuous. But really worse about it is by not prosecuting, by not using the investigative and prosecution arm to say this is illegal, he continued the idea that torture is a political or policy decision and that it's not just, period, against the law. You can't do it no matter who you are. So when you see evidence about bin Laden being found through torture, which is all BS, the pundits get out there and you say, see, torture works. So if you look at all of these characteristics that characterize the Bush administration, they are now characterizing the Obama administration. Guantanamo, Bagram, indefinite detention, preventive detention, innocent people kept, military commissions. We're talking about a fundamental change in American law and in really international law, to the extent the United States influences that or sets the standard for other people. It's really an unrecognizable world from what we had 10 years ago. One crucial aspect of 9/11 is what we would call the setting up of the surveillance state. We have many, many voices to talk about this. We go now to hear a few of these voices. The surveillance state includes incredible intrusions by the FBI in our daily lives, whether it be through the means of the Patriot Act, national security letters, wiretapping, what happens at demonstrations, the penning of people, the arrests of people, really the broad political police intelligence network that is formed by police, FBI, CIA, and others in the United States who want to ensure that organizing the right to dissent, the right to protest, the right to political protest is pushed underground, is pushed away, and is stopped. Unfortunately, it has been one of the key aspects of 9/11, the FBI guidelines that are now authorizing open season by the FBI on any one of us without any criminal predicate. Warrantless wiretapping, essentially on any one of us, without a warrant. Let's have a listen to some of the voices that have been deeply affected by the surveillance state that is now America. We ought to have a 51st state. Let's call it the surveillance state. Unfortunately, it would encompass all of us.
Governments are now biometrically registering populations with biometric identity documents.
What does that mean?
Biometrics is the use of biological traits that human beings have to identify people. So, for instance, fingerprints are the most well-known, but also things like iris scans, digital recordings of our faces, the dimensions of our faces, and biometric technology records those biometric identifiers and stores them either in a database or in a computer chip that can be embedded in an identity
document. Where do they get that from? I mean, where do they get your fingerprints from, your face, your
eyes were.
Well, they're, you know, it's interesting. Since 9/11.
Well, the threat of a grand jury subpoena, just the mere threat of a subpoena, has been used since 1968, when the immunity law changed, and I'll explain that a little bit later, to threaten activists with incarceration.
And then a case that you can still see how you have to keep fighting is the, it's called District Court. Arthur Kanoia argued it. It's the warrantless wiretapping case. It was the first case I worked on at the center in 71 or 2, maybe a little later. But it was during the war, Mitchell, the Attorney General, and Nixon said they had the right to warrantlessly wiretap anybody who was opposed to the war. It was a guy named John Sinclair out of Detroit. We find out about it because they try and prosecute him criminally. They have the wiretaps, and we argue that there was no right to warrantlessly wiretap an American citizen in the United States. And Arthur argued it in the court, and we won the absolute right to that you can't warrantlessly wiretap people, American citizens in the U.S. And of course, flash forward to the Bush administration, which then set up the entire program to warrantlessly wiretap. Believe me, everyone at my office, every Guantanamo attorney, probably half the people in this room. So more than half.
They started biometrically registering marginal populations. So, for example, the National Entry Exit Security Registration Program, right after 9/11, the government systematically registered all males between the ages of 16 and 45.
Is this your government in Canada or ours here in the States?
That's yours in the States.
There's a complete disconnect here from a common sense notion of what terrorism is, you know, that notion of inflicting terror in a civilian population is completely absent from their equation. When a full investigation is opened under the current policy for domestic terrorism purposes, the target's name is immediately put on the violent gang terrorist offender list, the VGTOF.
The grand jury functions in a very insidious way. Before 1968, if you were subpoenaed to a grand jury and you asserted your Fifth Amendment right, then that really was the end of your participation in the grand jury, because you asserted immunity, and if you were given immunity, then you couldn't be indicted.
Now, by immunity, you mean we have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate ourselves, and you were asked to speak before a grand jury or to answer questions, and you say, well, I have a Fifth Amendment right not to say anything, and I'm not going to say anything.
So even though you haven't been accused of a crime, you're out there on this list. And that VGTOF list is used by all of the terrorism screening centers and by the TSA and Customs Bureau. This report talks about two PETA activists who had been under an investigation, were on the task force list, and were stopped for extended delays in questioning 12 times over a two-year period during international travel.
Like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And they've also briefed law enforcement. And then at the same time, the cyclical nature of it is that the State Department and FBI and Homeland Security have in turn briefed corporations about the threat of animal rights and environmental activists. So it becomes really convoluted. I mean, we've created this top threat that I argue in the book, it self-replicates. It just continues building on that fear, and it becomes a kind of a monster of its own.
State Department figures, which are said to be inflated over, you know, a sort of a 10-year period up to 2004, the number of deaths around the world caused by terrorist acts, this is globally, is about 700. Compare that to Katrina. Compare that to the people that are dying from the lack of health care, that are dying in Iraq.
Although the issue right now is confined somewhat to the Muslim community, it is already leaking out and going into other kinds of communities. The government has been targeting environmentalists, for example, using somewhat the same theories. And now they're going after peace activists using somewhat the same theories. So we feel this is a very dangerous time for civil rights in the United States.
The activists who were given subpoenas for a grand jury in Minneapolis or Chicago, and I'm given a piece of paper by served by an FBI agent, but it comes from a United States attorney, and it says, Michael Ratner, you have to go down to wherever the courthouse is, and you have to go into a room with 23 jurors or something, grand jurors, all in secret. I have to walk in that room, and I don't have my attorney in there. My attorney, let's say it's you, Marge, you can stand outside, but I have to go in the room, and I'm in there with the U.S. attorney and these 23 grand jurors, and they ask me questions. They say, Michael Ratner, what's your name? And I say, my name is Michael Ratner. And I say, were you in Chicago on such and such a date? And I say, well, I'm not going to testify because that might incriminate me if I testify. Then they say, okay, don't answer. We'll get you immunity. Then they go get me immunity. They drag me in again. And then they say, what's your name? Or where were you in Chicago on such and such a date? And I say, I take the Fifth Amendment. And they say, well, no, you can't anymore because you've been given immunity. Then I mess around and I say, well, the First Amendment or something, my right of association. But at that point, they can haul me before a judge and do what with me?
This is assuming that you didn't use certain procedures that are available to you before that. But at that point, they haul you before a judge and you have a contempt hearing. The judge says, what are your reasons for refusing to testify? And listens to them. Generally, people assert the First Amendment claims, which are not deemed sufficient to overcome the immunity issues. So the judge then orders you to testify. You go back into the grand jury room. If you testify, that's one thing. If you refuse to testify, you're brought back before the judge, and the judge then holds you in what is known as civil contempt.
You know, once governments have a biometric identity document for everybody in their population and in foreign populations, the idea is that they have a sort of gold standard for identifying people so that they know who they're dealing with. But of course, biometrics is a highly flawed technology. It has high error rates, even for the best biometrics. And so, you know, millions of people will still be vulnerable to mistaken identity. Once they have that identifier for everybody is registered, they can start linking information.
You just heard some of the broad outlines and voices of the surveillance state. A key aspect of the surveillance state has been the attacks on Muslims. It's well known to all of us. They take many forms. They take the forms of the media, think tanks, and others labeling Muslims as dangerous, as subversive, as not American. They take the forms of the government prosecuting Muslims all over the country on trumped-up charges, using informants, on entrapments. The surveillance state, of course, has particulars that are aimed at the Muslim community in the United States and around the world. You could say the origin of the attacks on Muslims in the United States began with Bush's Crusader speech, made a few days after 9/11, in which he said the West was going to be engaged in a, quote, crusade to stop these, quote, terrorist attacks. Well, what is that about except Christians against Muslims? And that has characterized the core of much of American actions in this country. It's aimed at Muslims. It's aimed at Muslims on the street. It's aimed at them in terms of who they prosecute. It's aimed at who they surveil, having FBI agents go to every single mosque in the country, knocking on Muslims' doors. It's aimed by the media and think tanks to try and characterize Muslims as un-American. All of the junk you hear about the implications of Sharia law coming to the United States, all of that is part of really what has to be placed directly on President Bush's shoulders, the crusade against the Muslim world. It has its implications. Muslims are now a persecuted, very persecuted minority in the United States. Let's now hear some of the voices of the Muslim persecutions in the United States.
What is your religion? What mosque do you attend? How often do you pray? Now, these types of questions have nothing to do with criminal activity. It's really a harassment of these law-abiding Americans, and it creates a chilling effect on their First Amendment rights and their activities.
And that's really the key part of it, that when there aren't guidelines governing when and who the FBI should investigate, they tend to stray from people who we want them investigating. We want them investigating people who are engaged in wrongdoing.
It seems to me this is like a giant racist distraction.
Well, this is legal religious bigotry that unfortunately continues to happen.
And what we have found particularly disturbing is that this questioning goes into First Amendment protected speech, beliefs.
I believe that there is a systemic problem with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Individual agents whom I have had the painful privilege to talk to and interact with more in the past, I don't know, between 2001 and 2005, and since thereafter I don't speak to them, but during those conversations, they used to share that this is grandly stupid. They are just keeping us busy on doing things that has nothing to do with actual intelligence gathering.
And now, even though it's almost 10 years after 9/11, we're seeing it not get better, but get worse.
Right.
How do you see your work, and where do we go from here? I mean, it's incredible to me, coming out of the 70s and then out of, you know, the huge investigation against Central America people, which we exposed in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
And to see it even under Obama go so far downhill. I can't imagine what your work is like, but just what are you doing now to figure this out?
It's very frustrating because so much of what's happening is happening in secret. And you know, I thought it was really quite poignant when Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, during the Patriot Act debate, the reauthorization debate just a couple weeks ago, came to the Senate floor, and he has the advantage of sitting on the Senate Intelligence Committee, so he gets to see at least as much as any congressman gets to see as to what the FBI is doing. And he came to the floor and you know, warned his colleagues, and he said, you know, the government has a secret interpretation of this law.
It can be called entrapment, because what you have is people who have not committed a crime, who are targeted by the FBI, visited by the FBI, usually undercover agents. And in many cases, the people they use aren't even agents, they're informants that the FBI hired, paid government informants, some of them with criminal pasts, who are oftentimes from the same community. So in the cases I looked at, it's a Pakistani immigrant and an Egyptian immigrant who are in trouble with the law for different reasons. They are offered large sums of money and offered, in some cases, a plea deal for whatever crime they might have committed if they agree to work for the FBI.
What we know for a fact in Southern California, through ongoing surveillance of mosques, through the infiltration of provocateurs and predators in mosques, surveilling the sermons, surveilling the activities, attempts to recruit mosque members to keep an eye out on the clergy leader, the imams, and the mosque activities, approaching and intimidating and harassing students to recruit them to spy on the clergy leaders and the lay leaders of the mosques and reporting the activities. Folks coming back from travel, being stopped at the airport, again asking the similar questions: which mosque do you go to, what activities takes place in the mosques, and so on and so forth.
You know, many of you probably don't understand how the government is interpreting the law and the types of activities that they're engaged in, and collection activities that they're engaged in. And when the American public finds out, they're going to be very shocked and angry.
And the cases you looked at, Anjali, why don't you just mention those, the names of those cases, and a couple of sentences about them?
Absolutely. So there were three cases that I looked at, and I mean, these are three out of dozens of cases. The first case is the case that took place in Albany in 2004, which involves a Bangladeshi pizza owner and a Kurdish imam of a mosque. And both of them were convicted. They are now serving prison time. Their sentence was reduced from 30 years to 15 years because the case was very thin and there was an outpouring of community support.
But the people, the particularly that were targeted here, were very vulnerable people. These were people that had become somewhat exposed to Islam in prison, but did not know much about the religion. They were not, in some cases, practicing Muslims. They had other problems, like one of them had a crack cocaine problem. Another one had mental problems, very serious mental problems, actually. Another one was homeless for a while. These are people that were very susceptible to money offers and to the certain grandiosity that all of this was offered to them. You could have gone to almost any part of a city, upstate New York, and found people that would have been willing to grab at a deal like this. It was money, a lot of money, for potentially very little activity.
In any case, this individual calls, and I get his phone number, and I call this FBI agent, who I don't know. He's a rookie, I guess. And I called him on his behalf and said, what are you trying to meet this gentleman for? Of course, he was quite shocked and surprised to receive a call from me than from him. My conversation with him simply revealed he is simply revisiting the files that were left behind by his predecessor or whoever handed over those files to him. So he's simply reopening those files because the files exist on community leaders. And when a new guy takes charge of a particular area or section or a geographic jurisdiction, then they revisit all of that again. And I said, I'll be more than happy to meet with you. You need to come to my office and I'll have an attorney present. And at 99.9% of the time, it never happens. They never call you back.
We've covered a broad set of issues here on this special, 9/11's Footprint on America. But we have by no means covered the deluge that has descended on this world since 9/11. Some of that deluge was, of course, there before. Economic inequality, wars, civil liberties violations, and the like. But since 9/11, the escalation of the wars on the people of the world, and by wars I mean environmental wars, wars on their economies, and literal wars, has gone far beyond anything imaginable. But at the same time, many of these depredations would make us pessimistic. There's a lot of hope in the air and a lot of hope for change. We can see it in the streets of Egypt. We can see it in the streets of Tunisia. We can see it across the Middle East. We can even see it in our own hometowns of Madison, Milwaukee, and across the United States, where hundreds of thousands are taking to the streets. Change will come, but it will only come as people make change with their feet in Madison, in Cairo, and around the world. So while the administration and the elites have gone after the peoples of the world with great force, there is a fight back beginning, starting, opening, one that the next time we have a Pacifica special, maybe next year, maybe 10 years from now, we will be facing a changed and hopefully better world.
You're listening to Pacifica's 9/11's Imprint on America, 10 Years Later. This hour brought to you by WBAI. Our production team includes Tony Bates, Kathy Davis, and Sean Rhodes. I'm Jeff Brady. Stay tuned for KPFT with a look at the rise of the religious right post 9/11.